This is David Bell, and you're listening to Jaws of Justice on 90.1 KKFI. We're in the middle of our Justice series, and we've talked with a wide range of guests about what justice means to them. To this point, our discussions have usually centered around what results we're looking for from the criminal justice system. How did the results make participants feel? Were they heard? Today, we're going to switch gears and take a slightly different view. Today, we're going to talk about what information goes into the process, who has access to that information, and how the narrative that results can impact who's putting out the narrative, as well as the subject matter of the narrative itself. To help us with this discussion, we welcome Sheila Albers to our show. On January 20th, 2018, Sheila's son John was killed by a police officer responding to the Albers home to check on a teenager who was threatening to cause harm to himself on social media. Sheila, thank you for being here.
Thank you, David, for having me.
I want to start 4 years after the shooting, in 2022, and you met officials from the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division, the U.S. Attorney's Office for the District of Kansas, and the FBI. What was the purpose of that meeting?
I received a phone call that said a decision had been made, and they scheduled a meeting with my husband and I to let us know what they had decided to do regarding the officer who killed our son.
And so did you meet somewhere in Kansas City?
We did. We met at the U.S. Attorney's Office downtown, and at that point, there was an interim U.S. attorney, Dustin Slinkard, and then they flew in an attorney from the Civil Rights Division to meet with us. And so Steve and I went down and met with them in KCK. And, you know, we were given the devastating news that there would be no indictment of the officer who killed John.
And so at that point, you've heard what the results of the investigation were and the fact that the federal government wasn't going to pursue a civil rights claim against the officer. And I know you had settled the civil lawsuit against the city.
Correct.
In approximately 2019, about a year after the shooting.
Exactly.
But you wanted something more, and you made that known at that meeting. What was that?
The DOJ and the Civil Rights Division were very professional with us. I mean, they flew this person in to meet with us, and she asked what she could do for us. And I said, you can put out the facts. You can correct the narrative that went out about my son and get that information out to the public. And she said, I will do it. And so she started to take notes. And it was third week of August that meeting was. And I said, it for my the sake of my family and our friends and our community, the facts need to be out there in the results of your investigation. So September 9th, the Department of Justice released a 2-page statement in regards to John's death. And the narrative they put in their statement contradicted the narrative that was released by the police department and by the district attorney. And we have seen repeatedly across the country that false narratives are used to then clear the officer. And I want that system to change. I want families to have access to the evidence. I want them to be able to have the correct version of what occurred when somebody lost their life. That provides a truth and builds trust, but it also provides closure and it allows a community to heal. Without those facts, then there's always the tension of not knowing what exactly did happen when this person was killed. It also allows us to reclaim John's name. You have the act of someone dying, but then they're killed over and over and over again when those false narratives go out. And I want to see that pattern of false narratives and then the officer cleared to end.
When you and I have spoken before, and I was telling you that we're working in a justice series, and I'd asked you if you would appear, you indicated something about correcting the narrative and the intersection between that and your concept of justice. What did you mean by that?
In order for justice to occur, both parties have to have access to the same information. They have to have access to forensic data, to statements made, to witness reports. There's no justice when one side has all the information and holds on to all the evidence. There's no fairness in that whatsoever. And right now, local governments have entirely too much power to withhold information from the public.
Is there ever a time where you think there can be too much information out there? And the reason I say that would be the following. Every time something happens or doesn't happen in our society, it becomes fodder for social media. It becomes fodder for news content. It's just something to chew on. And my question is there ever a time where it's too much, or where the truth coming out is not appropriate in a situation like this? And I'm not saying there is such a situation. I'm just asking your thoughts.
I don't think there's ever a point where the truth shouldn't come out. The public is entitled to know the truth. Now, to withhold maybe something that's horrifically violent, you know, blurring a face, but not putting out a personal address or a phone number in order to protect somebody's privacy, you can do those things and also release the truth. The redacted videos released on John's case, faces were blurred, and those were appropriate pieces of information to withhold. Nobody needed to see that. But you shouldn't be redacting the beginning and the end of the video so that people can't see the moments leading up to it. Those are redactions in order to spin a different story. So I think you can protect somebody's privacy and maybe protect the public from something that's really violent, but those redactions should be minimum, and those pieces of information that are withheld should be really minimal.
You know, every minute that we live together in a society, we're agreeing implicitly on what justice means, or at least gathering around a general idea of what justice means. And perhaps that requires a constant ability to check that system with the information that comes out. Meaning, so justice is not necessarily just some concept we believe in. It's right now, in this next case, we're going to test our concept of justice and fairness, and that requires all the information.
It does, and I completely agree with you. You know, I think talking about justice as a concept is very difficult for people to get their head wrapped around. It's too vague. But when you talk specifics like a report or body cam footage or witness statements, those are specific places where justice becomes very real to a family or to a community.
You know, I also find that differences among competing narratives or differences among information that is available but is permitted to be broadcast to the public, those differences and who controls those differences sometimes gives me an insight into what those individuals or organizations are thinking. Meaning, why did a particular party focus on one area and not another? And I want, if you don't mind briefly, with you and your husband, the moment you heard John had been shot, you and your husband arrived on scene, and I get the impression from talking to you, law enforcement's actions at that time were beginning to create a narrative that didn't necessarily coincide with what you later found out from the Justice Department report. What was that narrative that was being put out at the very beginning, if you don't mind talking briefly about it?
Well, when we arrived on scene, I tried to run down the street to get to our home, and I was stopped by an officer, and I asked, "Is my son okay?" And he said, "He's passed." And I fell to the ground. They didn't give us much information in those next, you know, 30 minutes to an hour. And we knew gunshots had been involved, but we didn't own firearms. So we were very confused. And so they were kind of letting us believe that maybe John had died by suicide. My husband, Steve kept asking, "When can we see him? When can we see John?" And an officer finally said to Steve, "Well, we're waiting for the OSIT team. That is protocol." And my husband said, "What is OSIT and why do I care?" And he said, "Well, it's protocol in an officer-involved shooting." And that was the first hint we got that there was an officer-involved shooting. And then Steve said, "Why would a police officer shoot John?" So the next day, when the detectives came back to touch base with us, they were asking questions to paint John in a particular life. Like, was he drinking? Was he taking drugs? The statement that was released 24 hours after John was killed, that John exited the garage rapidly and aggressively towards the officer. So the narrative they were getting out was that John tried to run over the police officer while exiting our garage. And we know now that that is false, that that did not happen. But that's the narrative that they got out, and they got it out really quickly.
I know the other part of the narrative that you indicated they had put out there was that he was involved with drugs or alcohol.
And so on his Snapchat video that night that he put out, there was alcohol in front of him. Mm-hmm. But his toxicology report showed he was not under the influence of drugs or alcohol. He had a minor amount of alcohol, but the coroner's statement was not under the influence of any substances. Mm-hmm. We didn't get that toxicology report or the coroner's report until the end of March. We waited a very long time to get that information. And I'm assuming that they drug that out because the coroner's report did not match the narrative they were trying to spin.
So the narrative, as you understood it from the beginning, was, first of all, it was John's fault.
Correct.
That John had exited the garage at a high rate of speed while drunk or on some type of drugs.
Exactly. That paints a very clear picture to the public that the use of force would have been appropriate.
Was there also mention of mental health issues at the early stages?
Yes. I mean, because they talked about the comments he made on social media about wanting to end his life. Mm-hmm. Yes. And John did have struggled with mental health issues. That's no secret.
But as I understand it, and I did not review all the evidence that certainly you have, the responding officers did not know any of that information.
No.
When they came.
So Clayton Jennison, the officer who shot and killed John that night, had no information on John other than that he was being sent to a home for a welfare check. He had had no interactions with John, did not have any background information. He was really coming to our house with no background. And he didn't ring the doorbell. He didn't attempt to make contact with John. He had no background information to impact his decision one way or the other.
So with regard to narratives about John, I think we have a general idea. Were there narratives being put out there about you?
The day that the two detectives, the day after John was killed, came to talk to us, they attempted to separate us, to kind of grill us about John and our home. And we said, no, you're not going to separate us. And if you have any questions, you can ask us both while we're sitting here. And the conversation was very short. Steve and I were treated like criminals, like this was our fault or John's fault. 30 days after John was killed, the district attorney contacted our attorney and said he would meet with us to let us know what decision he had made regarding the officer who shot John. And when we met with him, no empathy, no compassion, no attention brought to who the officer was and why would he draw his gun at a minivan coming out of a garage at 2.5 miles per hour.
Well, it sounds like at that point, at the moment of the shooting, and your son was deceased, and that was a fact that no one disputed. And as a result of that, that made you and your husband victims at that point, certainly. And the impression I get from speaking to you, we've met twice, and I appreciate that. And today is there was never a time until that DOJ meeting where you were treated as victims.
No, you are absolutely spot on with that comment. We were treated like we were the cause of the problem, or they dismissed us.
In my informal study of human nature, I surely believe in the flight, fright, and freeze reactions during and after a traumatic incident. And at that point, our negativity bias, I think, as a formal survival kind of kicks in. And we go into defensive mode, and I think we kind of circle the wagons around ourselves. And then depending on what group we're in, I see groups, an individual group circling wagons around itself to protect itself. In doing that, we cut off ourselves from our better selves and I think from each other, and we miss out on something. And in reading the OSINT report, an officer shooting investigative team report that was issued on January 18th, 2018, I was surprised at the cover page. So the very first thing you see, which is almost, it seems in my mind, putting a narrative out about the narrative that's about to come. And it said, the OSINT report reflects a complete and thorough investigation and contains specific details about suicidal ideation. Those viewing the report should use discretion as such. Information can be triggering to those with mental health or substance abuse issues. The public discussion about suicide can influence behavior negatively by contributing to contagion or positively by encouraging help seeking. The impression I got from that is I'm about to read about a young man's suicide or an attempted suicide, which may or may not have been their intent. I don't know. It sounds like you believe it was, but in any event, that's certainly the impact it had on me personally, because it set the tone for me, and I had to push back against it on what I read in the actual report itself. My question to you, Sheila, is what was in the OSA report that you believe created a certain narrative, whatever that narrative was, including what we just talked about?
There was a predetermined outcome, and so they were going to use what they could to back that predetermined outcome, and that was the officer had a right to use lethal force, and John's mental health struggles gave them that perfect opportunity to tell a story that cleared the officer. So if you start off with, you know, John's mental health issues and suicidal comments, then you're not even aware of the fact that, gosh, this officer shouldn't even have unholstered his gun in the first place.
Well, I know you had indicated to me that they refer to John as a suspect in that report.
Repeatedly. And I didn't get to read that OSIT report until April of 2021. So it was 3 years, until I got to read it. And I remember reading it the first time thinking, why are they consistently referring to John as a suspect? What crime had he committed? But that let the reader of the report, you know, it makes John the person who's in the wrong.
It's a charged word for sure.
Right.
It's suspect. The use of the word itself creates a narrative. You know, the other thing I was surprised about is it included such personal things, and I don't want to go into the content of it, but private journals of John speaking about family members, as an example.
Yes.
That seems irrelevant to the investigation, at least looking at it from my lens, kind of a criminal defense attorney's lens, but yet that also would be part of the narrative.
Correct. It was cruel, because a 17-year-old boy is going to write things in his journal that are very private. And what that had nothing to do with the officer who came and shot 13 times at a minivan. A mental health crisis shouldn't result in a shooting. And it, you know, now it makes someone with mental health issues even more leery of law enforcement. It doesn't help the relationship. It actually damages it. You're going to be criminalized for struggling.
Well, and the other thing, and in terms of the circling the wagon I brought about, this defensive mechanism that we do individually, but also from an organizational standpoint, one of the downsides of doing that, in addition to what we've talked about, the impact on you and your family, is the impact of the organization itself. And there is, you know, one person whose mental health they didn't talk about in the OSIT report, and that's the officer that shot John. And what I found surprising about that is that to the extent I think you indicated to me through your research that he was a veteran, he served our country in the military, he was in some type of combat potentially. I've never done that, but I would assume that would have an impact. I don't believe he ever had any training to deal with mental health issues and calls like that. There may have been other things going on in his life I don't know about and I don't want to speculate, but there may have been other things going on. And yet the impression I get was that was never considered in the OSIT report.
You are correct. He put it on a resume that was pretty accessible to anyone on the internet, that he had completed 200 combat missions in either Iraq or Afghanistan. And then I found actually very recently that he has a YouTube channel where he has posted videos of his time serving in the Middle East. And it all raised huge red flags for me. I mean, what if he was struggling with his own mental health issues and now you've sent him on a welfare check, in addition to the fact that he did not have what they call CIT training, which is crisis intervention team training, and it's a 40-hour, pretty intense training that helps officers know how to de-escalate mental health issues. So, you know, we, as a community, we gave this combat veteran a badge and a gun and sent him on a welfare check without appropriate training.
And this circling the wagons again, this defensive mechanism, I guess in my mind it came into play that not just with this officer, but maybe others, as to what individuals should be officers or should qualify as police officers versus civilian positions, which police have. Maybe it prevents thinking as to what better screening may look like, and maybe better training. Meaning at the time, and hopefully things have gotten a little bit better, although certainly not where we want to be, but the focus on mental health, I know from speaking to people in the military, was, you know, almost non-existent. It was almost, you just suck it up and get in the truck and move on. But even in the police sometimes, the trauma that they experience, either the trauma they experienced before they got into the police force, but the trauma they've experienced during, is not being adequately addressed. And that circling the wagons and pointing the finger potentially, or the focus on John's mental health, it prevents kind of this looking inward that may actually benefit the police in a certain way.
Correct. If we expect systems to change or for society to improve and get better, then you have to look at all aspects of a tragic situation, not just one participant in it. And that's what is missing from this process. You know, I found a document about one of the debriefs that law enforcement participated in after John was killed. And it was so surface level. It just talked about what policies were followed and protocols, but it never discussed, like, gosh, maybe we had an officer who needed some mental health help himself. Or, you know, what could we have truly as an organization done better? And if we're not willing to have those, I think, very difficult conversations and reflect on everybody's participation, these tragedies will continue to happen.
I know the other issue that we talked about that certainly left an impression on me was the manner in which the officer left the department. What happened with regard to that separation, and what is it that you had to find in order to figure that out?
It was a huge, like, game changer in the sense of what we were going to be able to accomplish down the road when we found that severance payment. It was May of 2020, and our lives, meaning my family's life, had kind of calmed down in the sense that we were in the process of healing to a certain degree, and I had some quiet to kind of think through everything that had happened. And I verbalized to a friend, gosh, the circumstances under which Jennison resigned just seem odd. Do you think maybe they paid him off to leave? And I quite honestly thought that my friend would say to me, Sheila, that's crazy. Why would you think that? Like, come on. And this friend turned to me and said, I think they probably did. And then I thought, well, if they did, where would that money be documented? It has to be on a piece of paper somewhere. And so I kind of talked about it with my husband, and I as a former public educator, I'm like, well, budgets are public, like that. Those dollars are public. So I collaborated with a local reporter, and the reporter put out a CORA request, a Kansas Open Record request, and asked for payroll information from February and March of 2018 and February and March of 2020. This was payroll just for the police department. So we obtained those records, and you could see that the records were divided up in day shift, evening shift, and night shift. And there were no names on this. This was just dollars that were coming in and total dollars going out for payroll. And when I looked at 2018, only the evening shift, because I knew Jennison worked the evening shift, there was a bump in dollars going out on the March 2018 payroll.
And the shooting occurred again in January of 2018.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. And so I said to the reporter, hey, I think the money is here on this pay period. And he was like, well, that's great, but we have no name attached, so we can't prove it. That doesn't mean anything. And I just had this gut feeling that that's where the payout occurred on that payroll. And so a different reporter from a different media outlet said to me, Sheila, that information is public record. If there was a payout, you're going to be able to get it. So I stood in my kitchen with my phone and went to Google and said, Clayton Jennison, police salary 2018. And up popped a database that shows every public employee's salary for a given calendar year. And I saw in front of me, it said Clayton Jennison, 2018, $81,000. And in 2018, that officer had only worked 3 weeks from January 1 And I thought, well, how can someone make $81,000 for only having worked 3 weeks? And my husband was standing near me. And he goes, what's wrong with you? And I turned my phone around and I said, I think I found the payout. And he said, no second year cop makes that salary, especially have only worked a small portion of that calendar year. Mm. And I screenshotted it and got it out to people. And the media immediately contacted Overland Park. And the city had to confirm that of that $81,000, $70,000 of it was a severance payment.
And in terms of the narrative, and I guess this is information that wasn't made public until you found it, what did you infer from that?
Well, if he left under good circumstances, there's no reason to pay someone to leave. So to me, it was the biggest piece of evidence that this was a cover-up of police misconduct. Like, we finally had proof that they wanted Jennison to go away because he had done something wrong. And they pay him, and he goes away quietly. Then they don't have to terminate him, and nor do they have to deal with any lawsuit potentially coming from him. The video didn't match the narrative. Now we had a huge chunk of tax dollars going out to make an officer go away.
I see. And the narrative we're talking about, in that case, you're talking about government organization wanting to maintain the narrative that was out there and not wanting that disturbed by firing someone for cause and then having that person sue.
Yes.
And then all this information come out and become public.
Yes. Thank you.
Okay.
Yes.
You know, the other part of this was your lawsuit that you filed. And I know that one of the things that you brought up in terms of the narrative to me in our prior discussion was the answer that was filed in that case. Could you briefly talk about that?
So we filed our lawsuit April 17th of 2018, and the city replied to our lawsuit. It was the Friday before Memorial Day, and our attorney called us and said, hey, I need to prepare you before you read this because it is cruel, and it really... It's victim blaming, and it makes John out to be this awful teenager and you and Steve to be these really bad parents. And I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe that the vitriol that they spewed at us when we were the ones with a dead child. It became really clear really quickly that they were going to fight for the officer to clear themselves of any wrongdoing with every avenue possible, whether it was appropriate or not.
And the impression I got, and I don't necessarily want to go into the individual things, but you described it to me as it's just everything that would be embarrassing to a family to be brought out into public about, you know, during someone's life, particularly your son's deceased life, going back to like middle school disciplinary records or things like that, whatever it was that they could bring out, it was brought out and made public.
All of it. And it was not relevant to what occurred the night he was killed. It's 100% an intimidation tactic that cities use, is to do what they can to embarrass or paint the victim in a bad light so that it can very easily break a family, and then you go away because you can't take the stress and the pressure any longer. And it's intimidation, it's bullying, it's all in an effort to get it all to go away.
And from getting to know you, it seems like that may have been the absolute worst thing they could have done to you, meaning that was the absolute one thing that was not going to make you go away. In fact, it was probably going to make you fight harder.
Correct. I mean, you could tell that they were doing anything they could to get us to go away. And it did. It made me dig my heels in deeper because I refused to allow them to intimidate me, to my husband, my children. Like I was going to defend John, and I was going to defend our family because I felt at times very powerless, and I was going to take that power back.
I get the impression, Sheila, that, and again, we're looking back, certainly, but had the city approached you and your husband and your family immediately after the shooting, and the way the Department of Justice approached you and your family, that another narrative would have been created, a narrative that could have brought about healing much deeper and much faster than you've otherwise had to go through. Is that right?
That is correct. I, you know, Steve and I have talked multiple times about this over the last 6 years, that if the city had approached us and said, we knew your child was struggling and what happened that night should not have happened, and the officer is terminated and we are so sorry, I mean, you and I wouldn't be sitting here today.
Right.
We just wouldn't. I think that there would have been some accountability and some ownership, and the whole outcome would have looked so different. I mean, I think the lawsuit would have been minimal. Like, it just, the nastier they got, the more determined Steve and I became to make sure that the narrative was going to get corrected.
And I know that you eventually got a monetary settlement. And in negotiating ones in the past that I've done, certainly not to that magnitude, usually there's a confidentiality clause in those. Nobody wants anybody saying anything about anything. And we're going to agree, by the way, on what we are going to say if we have to say something to the media. You chose not to do that. In fact, that sounded like the biggest sticking point for you when we talked about how the case resolved itself.
That is correct. Mike Rader and Michelle Marvel were our two attorneys, and they knew from very early on in the case that at some point I was going to tell John's story correctly, and I was going to reveal the truth and the facts and the evidence that we had to the public. And so they both knew that us signing a non-disclosure agreement was just not going to happen. So when we went into mediation in December of 2018, we were ready to walk away from the entire process. If it came down to that, we were going to walk away. And I think the city was pretty desperate to close the case and get it over with. So our settlement agreement is like a page and a half. It is so short. And I'm very grateful to both of our attorneys who knew that I needed the freedom at the end of litigation to be able to talk about John.
I know that in our conversations and talking with others that your experience, the tragedy of it, has brought about positive change for police departments and for citizens and moving on in the future. And I know two of those are CIT training. I think that was something that was part of the negotiations that you went on with the city. But also the change in policy about shooting into cars. If you could talk about both of those.
Sure. So when we settled our case with the city, we actually, none of those were discussion points at that time. We just settled for the dollar figure. And then that is when I knew the real work would start. What could we do to change policy and training? And I would have the freedom to do that now because litigation was over with. So it took us 2 years, but we got the policy, the use of force policy on shooting into a moving vehicle changed. It is now banned in Overland Park. An officer cannot shoot into a moving vehicle unless the car is being used for mass destruction. And the policy when John was killed was that it gave the officer a lot of freedom to shoot into a moving vehicle, and that freedom is no longer there. So that's a huge win, I think, for the community. The second is that the city agreed to, and this took 2 years of work also, to train more officers in the 40 hours of crisis intervention team training. And I think the city is somewhere between 60 and 70% trained now as compared to, I want to say, maybe 45, 50% when John was killed. Training doesn't guarantee a perfect outcome, but it does minimize tragedy. Mm-hmm. And when there's a loss of life, it's a tragedy for the family, but it's also a tragedy for the officer. And so it's a negative outcome for everyone. So we have gotten funding, and the city has committed funding to do that additional training. They've also changed the training at the police academy. They've increased the amount of training they provide to their recruits on how to respond to someone in a mental health crisis. And then Overland Park, this is where I think they get really big credit, is that they began a behavioral health unit in their police department. It's called OPCAT, and it is staffed fully by officers and social workers who have CIT training. And this OPCAT unit now responds to mental health calls within the city of Overland Park.
You know, in speaking to individuals in other cities, they've indicated to me that because of you and your fight, that it's changed the shooting into vehicle policy around the state, perhaps even farther out than that.
The shooting into the moving vehicle piece, I was pretty passionate about getting that changed because it's bad police practice. But I have not heard what you just said, that it has impacted other cities. Now, I do know the mental health training has had a positive ripple effect other places. And I do think Overland Park's OPCAT unit, it's a model example of what a city should do in response to the mental health crisis.
As you're saying that, I was thinking about an interview I did with a veteran. And the veteran told me that when he came back from combat and was discharged, they just like said bye, essentially. And he never got treatment for what he had experienced in combat. I wonder, and I don't, maybe you don't know, and I, or you do know, if the officer that shot your son ever got treatment after that to deal with the trauma of what he may have gone through, or did he just get $70,000 and goodbye?
So the public now has a copy of the severance agreement that the officer signed with the city, because the media sued for that document. In that severance agreement, there was a stipulation that the officer would get X number of mental health visits. I don't know what that looks like. I don't know where that would happen, but there was mention of additional health benefit to him as he exited the police department. We need to be providing mental health help to everyone, and that includes our first responders.
You know, it's interesting as we've talked about a number of different players, if you will, in this saga. The one person who you've never really spoken negatively about to me, and I noticed this last time we met, was the officer that killed your son. That seems to be reserved more for the individuals that were pushing out the narrative, if you will. And I'm wondering, in terms of your healing, in terms of your narrative as you move forward, how did that occur? Or maybe why is that would be maybe a better question.
As I got more information on who he is and what he had experienced, I have empathy for him. He did a difficult thing by serving the Army and our country in the Middle East. I'm sure he saw some very horrific things. I don't think he showed up that night with the intent of shooting John. I feel the system failed him, too. I mean, why would you give a combat veteran a badge and a gun and no CIT training? I forgave him a long time ago for shooting John. I don't wish him ill. I've never felt like the solution was to throw him in jail. He has children. I want him to be a dad to his children. Really, my anger has always been at leaders who then excused his behavior, ignored the misconduct, and attempted to lie to the public about what happened, because then the problem never gets solved. It just continues to get shoved under the rug. Justice is not punishing the officer. Justice is, what do we need to change the system so the tragedy doesn't happen again?
Two more things, Sheila, before we conclude our interview, and I really appreciate you taking the time that you spent with me before this and then today. First, what's next for you in this? Is there more to do with what you're doing and what you've already done with regard to John and kind of the shedding light on a process here and bringing in CIT training for police officers, changing a use of force policy that will save lives here and likely around the country?
What's next is then taking some of the positive changes we've made here in Kansas City and Overland Park and trying to replicate some of those changes in other places, providing resources to communities so that they know how can they bring about those changes themselves. And ordinary people can do it. Like, you don't have to be an attorney. You don't have to be a reporter. You can be a mom or a dad wanting to see your city make some appropriate changes. I want to see better disclosure policies around body cam footage. Like, I'm really passionate about that. People think that because police departments have body cam footage that or body cameras, that then creates transparency and accountability. And really, the body cameras themselves are meaningless unless there's disclosure. And in Kansas, our disclosure laws are awful. So I want to see either local municipalities or statewide statute that requires disclosure. You know, there is a book in process right now that talks about John's case, but it also talks about my good friend Nareen Stokes and her son's case. And Ryan was killed by KCPD in July of 2013. And Nareen and I have become close friends. I mean, she is kind of my rock. And our stories together of two moms in the same city whose unarmed sons were killed by police, telling our stories will then help bring change to other cities. And that's, you know, that's what Nareen and I are going to be doing together here as that book potentially rolls out 24, 25-ish.
Final question, Sheila. You know, and I realize that in everything that I've talked to you about, I haven't talked to you very much about John, meaning I've talked about John and I've asked questions about John with regard to this specific incident. And so with regard to the narrative about John, a narrative unconnected or a narrative having nothing to do with this case, is there something you'd want me to know and the people that would be listening to know about John?
So John was, we adopted him when he was 18 months old, so I can't take any credit for his super good looks. But he was the most handsome, like white blonde hair and just blue eyes. And he had kind of a thick wave on the front of his head. And I wanted to touch it because he had the best hair. And he would like, Mom, don't touch my hair. He was very intense. Like he was, I've said this before, he's either all in or all out. That's why he loved being a goalie on the soccer team. It's why he was very loyal to his friends. But he struggled. He struggled with who he was and, you know, with his adoption. And we had a roller coaster with him of emotions. But like every mom, I always had hope that he would come out on the end of that as a young adult with more peace about who he was. And he wasn't given that opportunity. And, you know, a few weeks before he was killed, we were in the car and he said, Mom, I think I know what I want to do when I get out of school. And I said, what? And he said, I think I want to be a social worker. And he had done some work with his soccer club with kids who were disadvantaged and, you know, didn't have some of the things that kids in Johnson County have. And he loved playing soccer with those kids. And he said, I'm going to use soccer to help other people. And he said, but I know social workers don't make much money. And I said, well, that doesn't really matter. And it showed what a beautiful heart he had. And although he struggled with his demons, that heart was still there. And so I miss him. I miss him, and his friends now are all about 22-ish, and it startles me when I see them because I'm like, I still see John as a 17-year-old, you know, not as a 22-year-old, and, you know, so they're finished with school now. Some of them are actually getting engaged, and I think, what would John be doing now? But I also have peace that I know he looks out for me and for Steve, and he looks out for his little brothers, and that I will see him again someday.
Sheila, thank you so much for taking the time to be here and for sharing such a personal experience with us.
You're most welcome. Thanks for having me, David.
This is David Bell, and you're listening to Jaws of Justice on 90.1 KKFI.